Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Where Australia's doing some really great work is at the diplomatic level. Our space diplomacy is actually quite outstanding.
Let's not keep telling women to lean in or lean out or stand up or speak up or be more confident. Let's fix systems, not women.
You're listening to the National Security Podcast, the show that brings you expert analysis, insights, and opinion on the national security challenges facing Australia and the Indo-Pacific. Produced by the ANU National Security College.
Welcome to the National Security Podcast. I'm Danielle Ireland-Piper, Associate Professor and Academic Director at the ANU National Security College. Today's podcast is being recorded on the lands of the Ngunnawal and Ngambri peoples, and I offer my respects to their elders past and present. Today I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Cassandra Steer and Dr. Elise Stevenson to talk about women, peace and security in space. Welcome both.
Thanks so much. Great to be here.
Thanks for having us, Danielle.
Wonderful. So Dr. Cassandra Steer is the Deputy Director for Mission Specialists at the Australian National University for Space, also lovingly known as InSpace, and she's also Chair of the Australian Centre for Space Governance. Dr. Elise Stevenson is a Gender, Space and National Security Fellow at the National Security College and is also the Deputy Director of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership at ANU. So by way of scene setting for this pod, Cassandra Steer and I previously discussed the importance of space and the women, peace and security agenda. However, I'd like to invite both Elise and Cassandra to briefly recap the significance of those. So shooting to you first, Cassandra, what is the significance of space to security?
Yeah, so I think it's really important to get that context right, because I think it's something that people are sort of aware of, but you know, the starting point is that we're all using space every single day, hundreds of times, when you're checking the weather, when you're using your phone or your card to make a payment with PayWave, when you're using GPS either to navigate somewhere or get your Uber Eats, when we're dealing with climate change, when we're thinking about our agricultural sectors and our mining sectors, when we're thinking about getting proper information from Earth observation satellites about health of land and water, particularly freshwater bodies, responding to bushfires and floods. So it's you know, it's a major part of our local, national and global economies and lives, and it's therefore also a major part of all military operations. Militaries today, modern militaries, cannot operate without space systems for their communications, both their critical encrypted communications, but also if you think about forces when they're out deployed and need to communicate with their families back home, for their navigation of their own operations and also being able to track what adversaries are doing on land, at sea and in the air. Precision guided weapons use GPS, and then obviously you need it for intelligence and knowing what's happening on the ground or at sea or in the air, so situational awareness. So it's absolutely critical, and therefore space systems have become a really vulnerable aspect in military operations. So if you want to take out your adversary's eyes and ears, the best way to do that or compromise them is to target a space system, a cyber attack or jamming a signal. And then the other thing I would add to all of that is that most space systems today are dual use. So those very same satellite systems that are providing militaries with their capabilities are the same satellites that you and I are using. And so there's always, almost always, implications for civilians when those space systems are targeted.
Thanks, Cassandra. I can see there that there's a myriad of reasons why space is security. Elise, why then in that context is the Women, Peace and Security agenda relevant in the context of space and security?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that Women, Peace and Security, or WPS as it's sometimes known, has been something that's really grown steam over the last two decades in particular. So prior to then, you know, from the 70s kind of onwards, we had growing awareness of and moves around gender equality in all different kinds of government. And a lot of this was led at an international basis, often with the United Nations. Come 2000, we had the UN Security Council Resolution 1325, which was a real landmark occasion for basically recognizing that women and girls are implicated and affected by conflict and war, and therefore they should have a seat at the table. They should be at all of the tables where decisions are made, but also we should be doing our utmost to ensure that conflict, violence, insecurity does not further gender inequality. So, when we then apply that to space, the interesting thing is the space sector, military applications of space, as well as commercial applications of space, kind of developed around the same time that we had a lot of civil rights movements globally. But interestingly, there wasn't a lot of overlap. So we now come to the point where even 20 years on from the establishment of the UN Peace and Security Agenda, very few nations have actually turned their attention to applying the WPS principles and national action plans to space security. The upshot of that is that we are missing a huge amount in terms of the ramifications and what this might mean for nations, but also all of the opportunities. So some of the work that Cassandra and I have been doing is really to bridge this gap, to see, well, what would it mean if we applied WPS or Women, Peace and Security principles to the space sector and to space technologies? And how would this improve the way that we're currently doing Women, Peace and Security, not just here in Australia, but in terms of matching and kind of stepping up with our counterparts like the US?
Great. Thanks, Elise. And in that context, I note that Elise and Cassandra, along with Sarah Furman, have recently written a paper for the National Security College titled One Small Step, Women, Peace and Security in Space. And in that paper, you make a number of recommendations, in fact, four of them. And I'm wondering if you could speak to those. Throughout the paper, there's a reference to the fact that in not applying a gender lens to some of these really complicated issues, we're actually missing out. And I wonder if you could step out some of those recommendations, what they are and why you made them. So going to you, Elise, the first two recommendations involved putting in place targets and also a gender peace and security advisor role. Could you speak to those?
Yeah, absolutely. So the recommendations that Cassandra and I have really built on target our second national action plan, which, you know, amongst some of the pillars talk about increasing women's participation, reducing sexual violence in war, supporting the resilience, rights and justice of women and girls in conflict, and demonstrating leadership and accountability on a government level. What Cassandra and I have said is, you know, number one, we want to see that Australia's Defence Space Command, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, as well as the Australian Space Agency, put in place targets around diverse gender representation within space careers and related defence careers, and have pathways towards fulfilling these targets. A real reason why is because we continue to see underrepresentation in this sector. So more generally, in the Australian Defence Force, we're hovering at about 20% women's participation overall. If you have a look at space in particular, we actually don't know how we're tracking. So we're still waiting to see some of the first statistics on women's representation in Defence Space Command, for instance. Cassandra and I have been working with the Australian Space Agency around a new diversity and inclusion statement for the space sector, but there's still a lot of work to do to make sure that, A, we have gender representation in these government agencies just generally, and then also in specific domains related to space. For people who are working specifically in space agencies, that they have a real gender lens training and they are familiar with Women, Peace and Security principles. But also for those, for instance, in DFAT who have good Women, Peace and Security skills, that they have good space knowledge and space tech skills and capabilities. So that's kind of our number one, and it feeds into our number two recommendation, which is around Defence Space Command instituting a gender peace and security advisor role. Now, broadly across defence, of course, we have gender advisors, which have been really fantastic and have done some of the really important heavy lifting on this work. We'd really like to see that this is more comprehensively engaged in Defence Space Command, which would basically entail us matching what some of our counterparts are already doing. So we've worked a bit with the US Space Command as well as US Space Force with some of their gender advisors precisely around some of these topics. Now, they have a congressional mandate to apply the WIM Peace and Security agenda to those space commands and space forces. We don't have congressional mandate here, but we should be doing this. Our WIM Peace and Security commitments require kind of whole of government and cross-departmental implementation. So we really feel that there's a strong business case. And in fact, it's not just about that. It's about upholding our existing commitments, but also making sure that we keep in step with our major ally of the United States.
Thanks, Elise. And if I can I get you to unpack that a little bit? So I guess it's in some ways self-evident how having targets and a specific advisor can help advance the cause of women, peace and security in the space sector and in the departments that you've referred to there. I wonder, did you have any views on how that also translates to inclusion and participation as opposed to mere presence?
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess this goes a little bit to why this matters in the first place. I mean, we have really good data out there about basically gender representation, making sure we have women at the table in national security, in international affairs. It is correlated with greater consensus and collaboration, with lower interstate war, and basically reduce conflict and ability to navigate conflict better. So this is key, right? We are on a precipice. We really need to be thinking in a very holistic and considered way when it comes to space as a kind of security domain and one that is at times fragile. And Cassandra has mentioned a few of the ways in which space technologies can be used for kind of military purposes that could be quite damaging to our nations. So we are talking about maintaining peace better. We are talking about making sure people are represented and included. And ultimately, that means that there's both strategic purposes to ingraining women, peace and security in space, but there's also moral imperatives. You know, we are a representative democracy. Our governments are, you know, they are signed up to committing to represent the nation. This actually should just be self-evident to what we're doing.
And I guess you also referred to literacy programs in space, so improving space literacy, which I guess in turn helps improve participation as opposed to mere inclusion. So thanks very much for that, Elise.
I just wanted to add something on to what Elise said, because we, Elise and I put together a conference at the beginning of last year, 2023, that was the nation's first conference on diversity in the space sector, which was an amazing event. We brought people from across the country, brought people from across academia, from government, military and civil, and also some private sector. But one of the things we did was we held on the side a day-long workshop that focused on women, peace and security in space. And one of the things I really got out of that was learning to differentiate between the kind of diversity, inclusivity and accessibility agenda, which we're also very committed to, and Elise and I also do a lot of work on, in particularly for the space sector. But although that overlaps with WPS, it's not the same thing. So WPS is not talking about being inclusive and making sure you have a diverse space sector. It's really saying there are gendered implications of warfare. We know that. There's research that backs that up. There's research that demonstrates how women and girls are disproportionately impacted. Whether that's gender-based violence specifically or whether that's the impacts of losing access to water, losing access to specific technologies. And that really what we're saying here is we are also committed to diversity and inclusivity in the space sector, but here we're really talking about why you need greater representation, gender representation across all levels of decision-making when it comes to security operations, when it comes to conflict, when it comes to peace negotiations, is that the evidence bears out that when you have fewer women at the table, you have peace negotiations that don't take into account the gendered implications of what's going on. When you have more women at the table, those peace negotiations are longer lasting. When you have more women in uniform making decisions as operators, as decision makers, as leaders, you have a better chance of the mainstreamed gender lens being applied when we're talking about operations deploying and targeting and that kind of thing. So it's not denying the importance of inclusivity, but it is actually a bit of a different agenda.
Absolutely. Thank you. I think the point I was trying to make is how targets translate to participation. So it's one thing to be invited to the dance. It's another thing to do the dancing. So I think you've in some ways answered that when you've talked about women making decisions in that context. That's important rather than just merely being present. So thanks for unpacking that. And Cassandra, you also in the paper, yourself, Elise and Sarah, included two other recommendations. The third of those being that there should be commitments to considering the gendered implications of targeting space systems. So I guess we're talking about that gender lens there. And then the fourth was a call to update the Australian National Action Plan to explicitly include space, space security, and space careers in the armed forces. Would you like to speak to those recommendations, why you included them, and what you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So the fact that we really highlight that it's Defence's Space Command that should be adopting those commitments to consider the gendered implications of targeting space systems. So our Space Command, as of July 2023, was moved into joint capabilities, which I actually think was a really prudent move. It now is very much a part of a joint force and more at the operational level rather than it sitting primarily under Air Force. And that's because, you know, as we've been saying the whole way through this discussion already, these space systems and space services are just critical and permeating across the board. And so every military operation utilizes those capabilities. And it's often going to be Army, Navy, and could also be Air Force, but not always Air Force, who might be deciding to target a space system. And that's because targeting a system, as I said before, could include just jamming a signal. If you can jam a communications satellite signal, that means your adversary can't hear or can't communicate. Or you could be listening in for intelligence purposes, or you could want to undertake a cyber attack, which just compromises the space capabilities that your adversary is depending on. But if you're doing so because of the dual use nature of almost, you know, it really is the vast majority of all space systems these days are dual use. Our military and many modern militaries depend a lot on commercial providers. And so they're not just contracting with a commercial company to help them build a satellite or build a system, or, you know, in the case of the US, to launch with a commercial launcher. They're actually buying a service. Australia buys Earth observation data from commercial providers for our intelligence purposes. We buy communications service. We will eventually, in the next few years, have our own sovereign communications capability under JP9102, but we are very much a user and a customer and a client at the moment. And so,
Cassandra, can I just interrupt you there? Sorry. You referred to JP1902. Would you like to explain that?
Yeah, JP9102 is the program that Defence has is procuring a constellation of three communication satellites, and it's actually Lockheed Martin who is going to be building those satellites for Defence. They will be, once they're launched and operational, which is probably in another 5 to 8 years, they will be sovereign owned and operated, but it is a commercial entity building them for Australia. And that's because at the moment we don't have any sovereign communications capabilities. As I said, we're a client and a user as a nation.
But will they be, when you say they're sovereign, they'll be owned by government and administered by the private sector?
Yeah, that's right. So it's a private company, a key prime company that is building the satellites, providing the capability, providing the training to defense personnel. But once it's actually launched, once those three satellites are launched and operational, they will be sovereign owned and operated.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Thanks, Linda. Yeah. And then it's something I think that, again, we can take for granted when we're talking about space for military operations or for national needs, even at the civil end. Like, how do we know about bushfires and floods and respond to those natural disasters? That's part of our national security as well. We're depending on foreign providers for that data most of the time. And yet one thing our defense is already pretty good at and can do very effectively is target space systems, as I was saying, in these non-kinetic, highly impactful, highly effective methods and means of interrupting a space service. Even if you just do that briefly or temporarily, you've just compromised your adversary's abilities to operate. And what is
Cassandra, then, the gendered implication of that?
Yes, we need to take into account, if civilians are depending on those same services, what are the implications going to be for women and girls? So a great example, or a rather uncomfortable example, is when Russia launched a cyber attack against a US commercial satellite system called Viasat, specifically to take out communications for Ukrainian forces. And it was effective in doing so, but it also took out communications for all Ukrainians. And that's going to impact men and women, boys and girls, but given that we know that women and girls are disproportionately impacted in wartime, if they then lose their ability to communicate with each other, particularly if women are then, if it tends to be the men, and Ukraine is another very strong example, the men have volunteered to go off and fight, it tends to be the women who are then keeping the families together. If they've lost their ability to communicate, that has massive implications for them. If they lose their ability to access any kind of payment systems and access their money, because payment systems and money, our global finance depends on precision timing from satellites as well. That has massive implications as well. If, for example, there have been on the ground attacks which have denied access to communities to fresh water, again, that can tend to impact girls or women in greater ways because of the roles they sometimes play in society, and also because of the gender imbalance once there are more men off fighting. Then the ability for emergency services, relief services, and also militaries coming in to assist those communities, if we don't know that they've lost access to water, for example, because we've lost our Earth observation data, then that is going to impact girls and women disproportionately. And so if we are choosing to target these space systems to impact our adversaries, we need to be taking into account what the potential gendered implications are for civilians.
And I can see you nodding there too, Elise. Did you want to chip in on that?
Yeah, I just wanted to add, that one of our kind of major pillars of our National Action Plan, and a concern I think, that is shared by most Australians, is also preventing or reducing sexual violence in conflict. We know how prevalent this is, not just from kind of our adversaries, but also from militaries worldwide. We've got a lot of research on UN peacekeepers, for instance, being perpetrators of violence. If communication channels are broken down, you also miss that opportunity to keep people safe, but also to report or be able to be on hand to keep people safe. So I think that that's a really important dimension, particularly when a lot of our focus in women, peace and security is really on preventing that real frontline violence and how can we get people right out of danger right now. So I just add that that's another reason why this is so important and significant, and that why not just governments but also our civil society need to be, space literate.
Yeah, and I guess in the specific context of armed conflict, of course, you've got displacement of all sorts of people, including civilians, and we know the data shows that women and children are disproportionately impacted in displacement too and are more vulnerable to trafficking in persons. Cassandra?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. It really goes, everything that Elise and you just said goes to the fourth recommendation which we made, which I have to say we really thought long and hard about whether to include this final recommendation, which is saying that DFAT should update Australia's National Action Plan to explicitly include space systems, space technologies, space security and space careers in the armed forces. And the
Cassandra, what is the National Action Plan first?
So I think there's over 100 countries, at least you probably have a more precise number of countries have developed national action plans in response to the Women, Peace and Security agenda, in response to that UN Security Council recommendation. Security Council resolutions are very impactful. They're actually binding under international law. So when a state says we are going to adopt the Women, Peace and Security agenda, they do so by writing a national action plan. This is how we as a nation are going to implement these principles, both in terms of greater representation, but also in terms of protecting the rights of girls and women And national action plans can be updated and rewritten. They have various different cycles. We debated, though, whether or not to make this recommendation, because it can be a bit of a double-edged sword sometimes to go right down into the nitty-gritty and into detail in a national action plan. Because if you start highlighting specific technologies, why have you not highlighted other technologies? And if you start being highly prescriptive, is that going to be sufficiently flexible? And but in the end, I think we came down on the side of including the recommendation, because what we really want to we want people who are reading this paper, people who are working in these departments, to enter into a conversation about why this matters and to really think about what our national action plan does and perhaps fails to do, and what Australia could be doing more of around space security. You know, we have this huge opportunity. We have fairly young institutions. Our Space Command is only a couple of years old. Our space agency is only 5 years old. You know, we are playing a bit of a catch-up game in terms of how we're participating as a nation. We're very much a user, and we can be a better contributor. And here is an amazing opportunity for us to be walking the walk and to be, as Elise said at the beginning, really doing so in partnership with our greatest ally, the
US. And we'll come back to the issue of how we're looking in contrast to our allies and how we're looking in comparative context in just a moment, Cassandra, but we might just flick back to Elise. Elise, what is the risk if we don't do these things? So we've talked here about four different recommendations. What's the risk if we don't do them?
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, I think just on fundamental levels, if we continue to kind of perpetuate some of the gender imbalances in representational senses in our security workforce, whether that's space related or regardless, although I think we've established that space is everywhere and related everywhere, that's a grave just injustice on a moral front, but it also is opening us up to a host of risks in terms of our capacity to derive consensus, to make good long-lasting decisions, to avert conflict, to maintain peace. You know, there's some real strategic reasons there for individuals, but also for organisations and our ability to maintain sovereignty and fundamentally our national interest. But it also impacts on Australia's ability to meet our international obligations. So that's not just under the Women, Peace and Security agenda, which, you know, Cassandra explained, our National Action Plan. That's our roadmap. We do have obligations internationally to fulfil that. But secondly, the Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women. Long name, but in short, CEDAW. So there's we know that they are currently considering special measures. Certainly here at the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, we ran and participated in some workshops here in Australia and in the US in the last year around this new General Recommendation 40, which will include basically CEDAW considering special measures, temporary measures to ensure parity in international decision-making roles. Now, that's not specific to space, but it will have a flow-on effect to space. So if we're not proactive in adopting, I guess, some of the recommendations that Cassandra and I are putting forward, but more generally, like these are kind of best practice recommendations, then we do open ourselves up to a host of risks. And I think you also have to think about who is impacted at the end of the day. And we are talking about people who are in, you know, kind of exacerbated circumstances. They're already, you know, women already are experiencing, I guess, threat multipliers from climate change, from space, from AI, from technology, from all of these different sides. We have existing vulnerabilities in terms of gender equality, in terms of economics, violence and safety, leadership, workplaces, home life. Really, this is just a critical part. If we continue to ignore this dimension of women, peace and security, how it plays out in space, we're also just so far further behind than where we should be, and we're imperiling real people's lives here. That hurts everyone.
Yeah, thanks. Elise and Cassandra, you use the term threat multipliers throughout the paper. Elise, could you just briefly explain what you mean by that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the term threat multiplier has often been used in the context of climate change. And basically, how we use it in the context of space is that we have existing gender inequalities left, right, and centre here on Earth, right? And that's just what I mentioned before. So we have underrepresentation in leadership. We have the gender pay gap, which remains at around 13% here in Australia. You have underrepresentation more broadly, you have increased violence and discrimination. And then when you think about, conflict settings or I guess wars, and if you think about disruption to space technologies and as Cassandra has mentioned, the misuse of those technologies, you're talking about an exacerbating impact on the things that women and children are already facing. So this could make it that much worse.
In a peace context, women and children are more vulnerable to sexual violence or domestic violence, for example. And what you're saying is in an armed conflict, therefore, that is multiplied and intensified. Thanks for that.
Sure.
Yeah, great. So, Cassandra, you talked about our relationships with our allies. And Elise has talked about our international obligations. How are we doing in a comparative context?
In terms of space security in general, I think where Australia is doing some really great work is at the diplomatic level. Our space diplomacy is actually quite outstanding. When you couple that with the reputation Australia has internationally, though perhaps we're not so aware of it at home, as really taking a lead on gender issues in arms control in general and gender issues in bringing a gender lens to security issues more broadly. At the UN, for example, Australia really does take a lead when it comes to putting in resolutions to implement gender neutral language. Last year, I think there was a huge success with the new High Seas Treaty. Actually talks about the common heritage of humankind instead of mankind for the first time in a treaty. That stuff matters. And Australia really does push the envelope a lot at the UN multilateral level in terms of, as I said, a gender issue in arms control and security issues. And we're starting to do so when it comes to space security, and starting to be recognized as bringing those two things together in partnership with other countries. There's a bit of a core of like-minded nations, if you will, that include, the usual suspects of Canada and the UK, but also very, very important players in terms of space leadership, South Korea and Japan, who are light years ahead of Australia in terms of who they are as a space nation. And so when we start partnering across the relationships that we already have for technology and for space cooperation with the relationships we have around diplomacy and arms control more generally, we're actually doing pretty well. I think when it comes, though, to thinking about this at home and implementing it in terms of how our relatively young Defence Space Command is set up, what the personnel looks like, what the gender balance looks like, and really thinking through it's a complex bunch of issues to think through. I mean, you keep probing us with more questions to get a better understanding, which is really helpful, I think. But I think our Space Command is dealing with a lot of existential issues around what its role is, who makes up Space Command, what task does it have now as part of joint capabilities in terms of guiding all of the three armed services. And so it's really going to take some forward thinking, which is why we put in that recommendation. Let's have a gender advisor specifically for Space Command. We have a new commander, Major General Greg Novak, who I know is very open to these kinds of things. So that's a very positive sign. But it's going to take also, I think where we're lagging a little bit is really bringing together the civil and the military. As I said a few times, space systems are dual use. Militaries around the world depend on commercial partners and providers, whether they're buying data and buying a service or whether they're contracting with a commercial company or a prime to help them build the infrastructure. We cannot operate without commercial partners. So we have to stop thinking about commercial and military as being separate. And we really have to stop thinking about civil and military as quite separate. The space agency now has someone permanently embedded in Space Command. And they also have someone whose job title has includes national security. So we're starting to see a little bit more of that fluidity between the different agencies we have. But that's also going to require a sophisticated understanding of why these gender issues matter so much and how WPS actually goes beyond just a military purview. It's a DFAT responsibility. It might also become a space agency responsibility.
It sounds like there's an important call for integration there in our thinking, Cassandra. Elise, is there anything more from the paper you wrote or anything that's been discussed so far that you'd like to unpack or speak further on?
No, just to say that academics like Cassandra and I, as well as the National Security College more generally, this is what we exist to do, right? We do the research, but then we're partnered with practice and policymakers to be able to guide the next generation. So we've already heard from US Space Command and US Space Force that they are, you know, they're pretty keen and pretty interested in hearing some of the research and guidance on where they should go. We're here also to be able to do that for all kinds of, I guess, purposes around space, and I think that we've got a really good opportunity to help government this way.
We'll be right back.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
In a volatile world, Australia's strategic problem demands difficult decisions, licensed by an inclusive conversation. The ANU National Security College is proud to present Securing Our Future, a conference like no other, informing a distinctly Australian, people-centred vision of national security. Bringing together diverse Australian and international voices, we are bridging disciplines, professions, and viewpoints. Join us in Canberra on the 9th and 10th of April this year to engage with thought leaders and decision makers from government, academia, and industry. For more details and to secure your ticket, visit the link in the show notes. The ANU National Security College, engaging minds for a secure Australia.
And I've got you both here, as it happens, in the lead up to International Women's Day on the 8th of March. And I'm wondering if I could ask you both for some musings or some reflections on International Women's Day and what it means, if there's anything else you'd like to say in the specific context of space and security, but also if you'd like to make a personal reflection, or indeed, as Elise has just mentioned then, a reflection on the importance of having a nexus between academy and industry and academy and government in order to make sure that we're thinking about these things in the fullest way that we can. Cassandra?
Oh, yeah. So International Women's Day is obviously, it's a really important day. I sometimes think it ends up being more about having morning teas and chat sessions, and that's a great shame. The ANU's Institute for Space held a morning tea. Actually,
I was going to ask about the cupcakes. Yeah, the cupcakes bother me too.
Yeah. Well, we didn't have cupcakes, but we did have a morning tea. I mean, we used that time of day because we thought it's just kind of easier. A lot of women still attend to be the ones doing the school drop off if they have kids. And, you know, so morning tea was kind of a time that we thought would be easy for people to attend. But we actually had people come down from Sydney and up from Melbourne because we were holding it, I think, because of the role that ANU in space plays nationally. We also had Dara Williams, who was very newly minted as the deputy head of the space agency, come along. Not in any kind of official representative capacity, but just because it was an important conversation for us to be talking about women in the space sector. And out of that, it became really clear we need to have some kind of national network. And out of those conversations became very clear, actually, it needs to not just be about women. It does need to be about diversity more broadly. And so Elise and I are actually part of a wider group of women, men and women, who have been working together on putting together a national network, which will be a soft launch a little bit later in March, is the Australian Space Diversity Alliance. So it grew out of International Women's Day, but But really, it became clear to us that that is a great and important platform, but it's not enough. And that's where I said, although the WPS agenda is not strictly about diversity and inclusivity, all of the issues we've just been talking about demonstrate why you need diversity in the workforce and you need to have mainstream these lenses. So we're focusing also on Indigenous representation, on LGBTQ, on different ethnicities, on different disciplines and backgrounds, and that is what our space sector really needs going forward. So I guess it's a bit of a pre-plug for a soft launch of a new a network, a new alliance that really is open to anyone and everyone who wants to become part of it.
And you heard it here first. What about you, Elise? Any space or end or personal reflections on International Women's Day?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that being part of the Global Institute for Women's Leadership, it's often in our title that this is something that we do a lot of events and initiatives around. But really, for us, it's not about a celebration of, you know, gender equality or women's achievements or whatever it might be. I think for us, we really see it as a push for greater momentum. So I would be encouraging people not just to have those morning teas, not just to thank the, you know, one woman in your office or in your decision-making table on that day or whatever it might be, but rather how can we continue to push for greater momentum on gender equality? And I think, you know, some of the things that are concerning me is that we're seeing backlash and kind of pushback against gender equality and feminist movements globally reach a pretty terrifying inflection point. I mean, just last year at one of the world's biggest conferences on gender equality, the very worrying statistic was shared that the total anti-rights, anti-gender movement globally gets funded about 2 to 3 times that of the pro-gender, pro-LGBTIQ plus movement. So we're looking at not only pushback that is on the rise, it's also pretty well funded and organized. And I think it does need us to continue to maintain the momentum because progress isn't guaranteed. So I guess given gender equality isn't a given, and it's frequently even more marginalized in security spaces, let alone space security spaces, I think that my message would be, you know, let's not keep telling women to lean in or lean out or stand up or speak up or be more confident. Let's fix systems, not women.
That's a great line. Let's fix systems, not women, and have meaningful structure reform. And listening to you then, Elise, I'm reminded of a chapter you wrote with Susan Harris Rimmer on gender and national security in a book that we're soon to publish with Federation Press on national security law in Australia. And I remember reading you both made the observation that there is actually a link between misogyny and violent extremism. And so this is not simply a moral imperative or a fairness imperative. There are real security consequences to not taking women, peace and security seriously. And I just wondered if you had any further comment on that.
Yeah, I think that this is something that we've seen not a huge amount of focus on until recently. And we have seen governments like across Canada, for instance, as well as a few kind of movements even here in Australia to recognise kind of the correlations between terror organisations and basically being underpinned by violent misogyny and what that link looks like. We also know that there's relationships between, in countries like Australia and the US, misogyny and white supremacy. So we're talking about a real complex intersection of gender, race, violence, not just at maybe a domestic or a kind of a interpersonal level, but we're talking interstate. So I'm thrilled that there's more attention that's being directed towards basically the link between misogyny and violence and terror on an interstate level. But I guess my big message would be for any of you policymakers or decision makers out there, look into this, read up on it. It's a really important and worrying trend that we need to divert more resources and understanding to and interventions against.
Thank you, Elise, and thank you, Cassandra. I think if nothing else, we've taken away the idea that International Women's Day is an important opportunity to open conversations and dialogue about further structural and practical reforms. I'm so grateful for both of your time. We're very privileged to have you here today, and I'm really glad you've written this paper. I think it's a really important paper with some great recommendations to platform into advancing these issues. Thank you both.
Thanks, Danielle.
Thanks so much.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.